On this episode of Narcissist Apocalypse, we talk with an abuse survivor named Emma. And Emma was in multiple abusive relationships. It's a story of intergenerational trauma, self-worth, trauma bonds, manipulation, changing abuser types, physical abuse, and self-discovery. Welcome to Narcissist Apocalypse, everyone. I am Brandon Chadwick, and with me today, we have Emma. How are you?
Hi, Brandon. Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here with you today.
Well, thank you for being here. And if you want to be a guest like Emma is today, please do go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's the button that says guest form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our guest form page. And there you can read all of our instructions. And then either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. And today's episode has a content warning, as we do graphically discuss physical abuse, sexual assault, sexual coercion, and suicidal ideation. So that is your content warning for this episode. And today we're going to hear Emma's story, and we don't normally do a trio of abuse stories, as we like to concentrate on one and get into like the nitty gritty of that one story. But today we are moving away from that. Emma wants to discuss the intergenerational trauma that contributed to the decision making and wanted to make things about her eventual self-discovery. And there may be language in this episode where you may say that this is victim blaming, but you know, we're not here to be victim blamers. We're not victim blaming. We're just going to be discussing things that made Emma more susceptible to being in abusive relationships. And also, it's not to say that everyone comes with issues or comes from trauma beforehand either. No one deserves to be abused, and many people get turned around and lose their identities at the hands of these abusers or coercive controllers solely based on the manipulation that goes on within the relationship. So with that being said, we'll be telling three quicker stories. Emma will have three quick stories of different types of abusers that she had relationships with, and we will focus on specific things within each story, as the overall theme will be about decision-making, self-worth, why Emma stayed in self-discovery. And now I'm just going to get out of my way and your way. Emma, the floor is now yours.
Thank you so much, Brandon. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. I just wanted to start off by thanking you for all your incredible work over the past few years. I've been listening for a long time, and you've really made a huge difference to my life. It's had a real impact on my healing journey. I just wanted to say thank you for that. And also want to thank everybody else who's actually gone ahead and shared their story in the past as well, because it allows us to, you know, recognize the patterns. It allows us to feel validated and know that what we're going through is real. So really want to thank everybody for that. So I'd like to kind of give you some background first on how I got to where I got. And I like to call it unholy trinity. That's my comedic way of calling my three terrible experiences I had, because I think it's important to try and keep some humor in our lives. But let's first start with kind of where I came from. So my background, I grew up in a very isolated way. So I grew up in a country in Europe. And then because of my parents' job, we moved to the other side of the world. So we were away from extended family and friends and things like that. So I was very isolated as a person. And there really wasn't much support. I would say every day was sort of terrifying. There was a lot of anxiety and isolation. I moved to a country where I didn't speak the language. So that was a challenge as well. So I had some issues connecting and getting friends early on. So there was just really no one I could speak with or discuss what was happening in the household. So in my household, I was the black sheep My sibling was the golden child, and no matter what I did, I couldn't get it right. So rules would change constantly as well. I once got beaten quite terribly because I folded a tea towel wrong. So every single day I was walking on eggshells. Everything was criticized. Nothing was ever good enough. And in that time, I learned that my value really was to be the family clown. So I developed a sense of humor. I tried to lighten the tension by being funny, which, you know, is a great asset to have, but it was sort of created under duress. And the other thing I noticed as I got older, I became, active in the creative space. And so what happened when I was about 15 is I was seen on the street and asked to do modeling, which for me, coming from having not been valued as a human being at all to suddenly being valued for something was really, really exciting to me. And I felt really, you know, blessed to have that happen. And so I thought, okay, my value is I help everyone. I'm in service of everybody else. I'm attractive, and I was at the time. So that helps. And I thought, you know, I have to be funny and interesting and all these sorts of things. So without realizing it, I was actually completely depersonalized. I didn't think of myself as a person, which sounds quite extreme to say it out loud. And I never would have been able to vocalize that previously. I wouldn't have been able to verbalize that. It's now on reflection that that's the case. And the three experiences I had really did segment that and show that off really ultimately. So I didn't know what my value was. My situation at home was so extreme. I ended up moving to the big city. I also had creative pursuits that I wanted to explore. But, you know, that's challenging. I'm moving to a big city. I don't have, you know, financial income at that stage. I moved when I was very young, late teens, and I didn't know anyone there. So again, I'm isolated. I actually don't really understand what's happened to me growing up. I can't really put my head around it. All I know is that what I experienced at home was so extreme that I started suicidal ideation at age 8, so very early on. My sibling also did that too, so we would regularly talk about that. But that kind of continued, and really I moved to this big city being extraordinarily depressed, very isolated, suicidal. And it got so bad that I would cry every single day, to the point that I had gotten a numerous amount of jobs to try and, you know, support myself, but I couldn't really function because I was just a wreck of a person, really. So I went ahead and ended up speaking to somebody about that. And my doctor put me on antidepressants, which helped to some extent. It helped me become numb, though. So I wasn't super functional. I mean, I was able to get through the day without crying, but I wasn't, you know, enjoying my life or anything like that at all. So in this state, I am depressed, isolated, I'm working extremely hard to recover financially and try and build something for myself. I'm working at night all the time in order to allow for me to be able to do creative pursuits during the day. So I've got a very unusual lifestyle, I would say. And then through the antidepressants, I ended up gaining a lot of weight as well. And so I was very uncomfortable in my body. I would not go outside unless it was dark because I didn't want people to see me, which is kind of depressing when I say it out loud, but that's how it was.
So you spoke about how you were the black sheep of the family and that your sibling was the golden child. So what was the relationship between you two? And were you able to openly discuss with them what was actually going on within your family? And I assume it was very difficult to make friends. You know, you're in another country and you don't speak the language. You might go to a school possibly that has the same language as you, but, you know, you're a family that's displaced. So is your sibling the one that's keeping some sort of normalcy for you in the sense of you are not crazy? And do they have the same issues as you, or are theirs completely different? Theirs maybe because they're the golden child, like weighted expectations and things like that.
That's a super good question. So initially we had that bond, my sibling and I, we could talk about it. And growing up very early on as a young kid, we did used to speak about it. They're 3 years older than me. And we would say, you know, oh, that person's hit me again. And, oh, we're constantly in trouble. So we would sort of support each other. And they also would actively try and commit suicide very early on. However, what happened was at some stage, my sibling figured out that if they help this parent in abusing me, they're in the clear. So they started to kind of collaborate with my abuser to abuse as well. And that took that spotlight off them. And it meant that I kind of had two abusers now on me at once. We had the absent abuser. They just were never around, so they didn't have to see any of this going on. But yeah, my sibling changed extensively as a person. They grew up having a lot of empathy. And then over time, it almost felt like all their emotions just shut off completely, which I think was their coping strategy, and probably a very effective one, and one I used to be quite jealous of, because I grew up being extremely caring about people and loving, and I just wanted to make the world a better place. So I always was very sensitive to people and things like that. But they were able to cut that off completely. They allowed the abuse to kind of fester and get worse, really. And I still have a working relationship with all of my family, because I am quite close now to my absent parent. But yeah, it's obviously very hard for me to interact with my sibling, because there was a huge betrayal there growing up as well. Yeah. So yeah, that's very heavy, heavy stuff. And I didn't know, because of the way I grew up and being so isolated. And as you mentioned, I did make friends eventually at school, learning the new language. I made some friends. But a lot of it that was programmed into me is that there was something inherently wrong with me. That's how I got myself into this position. It was me somehow. And, you know, if that's supported by two other people, my sibling and my parents, and that's my frame of reference, I'm going to believe that. So I didn't really deeply question it. I just thought I was annoying or difficult. So I tried to minimize myself as much as a person, take up as little space as I could, but try to be fun when I had to be. And that was really what I was doing there. So, you know, starting at a very, very low place, I'm very vulnerable at this stage. I then moved to the big city, not understanding what happened to me growing up. And I am overweight, uncomfortable. I go to my friend's party and I meet this person. I'm at the bar ordering a drink. This person comes up to me and is extremely confident. I've never met anyone this confident in my life. So his name is Ben, and he was so charming. He could charm the pants even off you, Brandon. He could charm the pants off just about anyone. He had that ability to look you in the eye and make you feel like you were the most incredible person in the world. Now, obviously, coming from where I've come from, that's super attractive. And, you know, he said, you know, let me take you out for a drink. And he was very interested. Now, at this time, as I mentioned, I wasn't having much romantic stuff happening, because I was self-isolating, suicidal, and overweight. So to have someone see me and be interested in me was just so exciting to me. So we went on our first date, and he was very engaged, asking me lots of questions, super interested in me. And he'd heard from the mutual friend that we had that I had pretty tough upbringing. And he knew a bit of background to that. So kind of unprompted, we went to a theme park. And on one of these rides, he suddenly said to me, look, I'm your family now. And this is first date, first hour in. So obviously, I'm sure for you, Brandon, red flags are ringing, bells are, you know, being rung right now. For me, with no real experience with this sort of stuff, I was like, I did feel actually deep inside, I went, oh, that's very quick. And I thought that was a bit ridiculous to say it so quickly. But without knowing it, it actually did kind of settle inside of me and made me think, oh, okay. And so what happened, I was a part of their friendship group. I got included in all sorts of social activities. And it did feel kind of like a family. You know, a very large group of people were suddenly a part of my life. And he was kind of the focal point of that. The thing that was interesting on the first date, and I you know, in hindsight, of course, all of us speak like this. But I remember we went to a bar after the theme park, and we were having a drink and things like that. And he started speaking to other people there. So he was, you know, kind of including other people in our conversation, strangers or whatever. And I was doing my usual comedy routine, and some people came to join us. And somehow it ended up that a group of guys were kind of just laughing at my jokes and standing around me. And all of a sudden I turn around and he's left this bar and left me by myself because he got angry and jealous, which is kind of strange. We'd never even kissed at this stage, but I ran out after. It was very dramatic. And I ended up calming him down. I gave him a kiss, and then things went from there. So that really should have been a first red flag, but there would be many more of those. So the thing that happened as things started developing, I spent a lot of time with him and his friends. They were kind of my social world. And I would say support, but to be honest, I mean, this guy was basically, under Lundy Bancroft, we would call him the player. Just extremely charming, kind of shallow, very funny kind of guy. So I wouldn't say I had much support, but I did feel like I was included in something. But one of the things that he started doing was, I remember he was looking at some photos of me in my modeling days, very early on when I was like 15, 16. And he said, "Oh, why don't you look like that anymore?" And, you know, obviously there was a whole bunch of reasons why I didn't look that way anymore. So I decided at that stage, okay, I need to lose weight, because he would continuously go on about gym work, eating, all sorts of things. So I ended up developing an eating disorder, which was kind of a first indicator to me, really, that something was going on there as well. The other thing that started happening over time as our relationship developed is he would first make suggestions about the clothes he would like me to wear. And it would be like, more like, "Oh, you'd look good in this." So it started in quite a nice way. And this is really how these relationships develop, right? Frog in the boiling pot. It's very small. And then you learn over time that you just need to be compliant, and then your life will be easier. But as you're doing that, you're losing your sense of self. So it can be very, very disorientating. But eventually it turned into much larger control there. So I remember one day he was about to go on a Bucks party, and I knew he was going on that on the Saturday. So on the Friday, he had to pick a fight with me. And this is something you'll often notice with these sorts of people, is when there's an event coming up, particularly an event that could be quite intense, they'll try and pick a fight to unbalance you. And the day before, he texted me saying a friend of him saw me wearing a low cut top. And so he called me a slut. And he said, you know, "A woman like that is not the sort of woman I could get married to, etc." Now, this top was literally just below my collarbones. It was nothing dramatic. But he created a gigantic fight in order to be able to justify basically not speaking to me for the next 2 days. It's very much like he has his rules and I have my rules, and they're completely different. I have to be sort of perfect virgin angel, and he has to be whatever he wants to be, really. This relationship went on for 4 years. It just continued to escalate, and the control happened in all different kinds of ways throughout, mainly around jealousy, around, you know, controlling what I wore and stuff like that, and telling me, you know, to lose weight. So after this eating disorder, I actually became anorexic. I became like a skeleton. And he then told me, "You've lost so much weight, you now need to get implants because you've lost all your body weight." So it was like, I can't win. Either you want me to be curvy and bigger, or you want me to be thin. I can't be both. So that was an interesting time as well. Luckily, even at the time, I decided I wasn't going to go ahead with that. So I'm very proud that I was able to stand up for myself there. So then what happened is his jealousy kept growing, which was interesting. So it got to the point where if we are in a restaurant, we're having a conversation, if I even look in the other direction at another person, and if they happen to be a man, he was convinced that I was trying to give that guy the eyes or something like that. But things kind of kept escalating. I got a weird DM on Instagram from a girl saying she'd been with him while we were together. There was lots of funny signs of things that were going on there in terms of him not being faithful. Then one night, I lived in the center of the city in a small studio, and he kind of would use it as a hotel because he lived a bit further out. So he was at his Christmas party and he was texting me saying, hey, I'm going to come over and hang out at your place tonight. And so I was all dolled up and ready to accept him to come in. And he just wasn't replying anymore. So I was waiting and waiting. And then at about 2 a.m., I decided, okay, I'm going to try and get some sleep because clearly he's not turning up. But I was very anxious because he put me on edge all the time. He had all sorts of tactics for that. I will say in the 4 years, there was also a lot of charm and loving elements. Of course, every single time he thought he was about to lose me. So, you know, that was there. But I was trying to get some sleep because he clearly wasn't answering. And then about 3 a.m., the buzzer rings of my studio apartment. And he'd been at this Christmas party all night. I could barely understand him over the intercom, what he was saying, because he was so extremely intoxicated and high. And I'm trying to speak with him and I'm like, look, it's super late, et cetera. He's like, no, I'm going to come up. And so I let him up. And I always wanted to be perfect because I thought I had to be perfect. So I thought, okay, I'll quickly jump in the shower to make sure I'm nice and clean and we can get into bed together. So I'm in the shower, I'm showering away. And all of a sudden, the shower curtains pulled aside. His bloodshot eyes are there and he pulls down his pants and he starts to urinate on me to degrade me. Obviously that was quite shocking to me. And again, I'm proud of this. It freaked me out enough to instantly call the police. He ended up escaping from my apartment and I didn't press charges. Things just sort of kept escalating and escalating. Again, at this stage, I am doing a lot of creative projects. I'm slowly getting a little bit more confident. So then one night, this is the end really. He and I are lying in bed together and we're cuddled up. I'm lying on his chest and underneath his pillow, he has his phone. His phone keeps going buzzing all night. Now, I've already got severe sleep problems because of all the stuff that's going on. And I try and move the phone so at least it doesn't vibrate the whole bed while we're sleeping there. But I can't because his head's on the pillow. So I end up moving it to the point that he wakes up. And then he spends the next 5-6 hours till the morning frustratedly turning back and forth because he can't get back to sleep. The next day, I know I'm in trouble because he's not speaking to me. He's got the black shark eyes when he looks at me. And so I need to go to work right away. So I quickly try and brush my teeth as quietly as possible, trying not to incite him and just rush out of the apartment, even without a shower. I just want to get out of there. But as I'm doing that, he's in the bathroom about to get into the shower. And as he looks at me, he goes, I'm going to slit your throat. So that was a very interesting moment for me where I realized, okay, this is now turning into serious life danger stuff. So I realized I had to emotionally detach from him at that stage. He had done other violent things to me before, but this was a real, trying to kill me threat. So I was a lot more scared about that. I ended up leaving that day and we sort of still had some interactions. He even one day surprised me and left an iPad at my front door. So there's a lot of charming going on there. But then this girl that had hooked up with him, I asked her more questions. I said, so what happened here exactly? So, you know, at that stage, I realized this has to be done. The thing that sucks about that situation is it was really only when all the cheating was confirmed and I ended up being about 20 different women in our 4 years together. That's really when I decided to leave. It should have been every single other thing, of course. But the cheating gave me sort of something to hold on to. And if someone goes, oh, why did you leave the relationship? It's an easy answer. But it should have been, of course, many other things before that time.
So when we talk about the relationship here as a whole and you saying there are so many other things I could have left for before.
Yeah.
What is going through your mind, I guess, throughout the whole entire relationship? Like, what are you holding on to with this person specifically? What was their hold on you, or did it have nothing to do with them in particular? Was it a lot from your end of how you were feeling about yourself, and then they then fed into that and made it a lot worse, making it more difficult for leave? Like, did you think that no one else is going to accept me because this person, because it sounds like they're kind of influencing how you should look, how you should be, how you should dress, all of these things. And then you're doing your best to comply to it in very unhealthy ways.
Yeah.
So you're trying to fit the mold of somebody else to hold on to them, which isn't love. You know, so where are you coming from, if that makes sense? I'm not here to victim blame in any sort of way.
No, not at all. I appreciate that. I absolutely not. And of course, there's also a part, like, I'm a participant in this too. Of course, the real guilt and shame should be with Ben, not with me. But I 100% agree. I'm participating and allowing this. And I am indeed trying to comply, but also he's changing the goalposts the way that my parent used to do in the past. Like, first it was, hey, lose weight, and now you're too thin. So it's not even something I could ever achieve anyway. And I didn't realize that until later. But the question really that you asked that's crucial is, you asked, you know, this is not love. Why are you sticking around? But I didn't know what love was. I thought love was being compliant, being a servant to somebody, and trying to show and prove to them that I'm worth their time. So I, at this stage, I would say I had an extremely low level of consciousness. I didn't understand anything. I hadn't properly reflected on what happened to me growing up. I didn't understand it at all. So I just wasn't thinking about that. And that's actually a really important point, is I wasn't focused on me at all. I was focused on them and trying to fix this situation. It even got so sad at one point because he just kept being so abusive. I ended up drawing a diagram to explain to him how he should put himself in my shoes. And I did all this extra stuff to try and get this explanation across to him. I wrote huge essays about it. I did all sorts of stuff to try and explain to him to have empathy for me. But ultimately, if someone chooses to misunderstand you, you're never going to get your point across. And that's really what happened here. So I would say the real answer is yes. I just didn't. It's not that I didn't think I could find another boyfriend. It was more that he's the one that chose me. He's the one that said he would be my family. And, you know, I'd already left my family that I never really had growing up. So it was like, I have to go through that again. And, you know, it was just a lot of trauma. I wasn't doing very well, that's to say the least. But eventually, one day, I decided, okay, I've got to leave. I've got to cut all this off. I Googled all the strange things he did. And then I actually decided to Google all the strange things my parent did. Now, this is 10 years ago. And all of a sudden, narcissistic personality disorder popped up. And this is when it was kind of in its infancy, to be honest. It's really developed in the last 10 years. And back then, we had people like Sam Vaknin and those sorts of people talking about it. Now it's become a buzzword. Everybody throws it around. But, you know, on social media, people are saying the word gaslight all the time and not using it correctly and stuff like that. But it was really exciting for me to suddenly see, when I was reading through these profiles of MPD or abusive people, I recognized, hang on, that's what my parent is. And then I went, and the feeling I have with Ben is exactly what I have with my parent. And so then it started clicking. So that's the first time that I actually started thinking, oh, maybe not every single thing is my fault. That was the first time that that started sort of clicking in a way. I still didn't think of myself as a person. So it was an interesting time. I decided to move back to my home country because I just couldn't be in that big city anymore with all those horrible memories. I just wanted to be away from everything. And so I moved away back to Europe and tried to kind of start a new life. The other thing that had happened is my friends that I had back in the big city, they'd all become part of Ben's group with all their friends. And so it was all very intertwined because Ben was a very popular guy. He was very, very popular socially. He could get into the best parties. So unfortunately, the friends I had at the time also kind of got integrated into that, and they were not really supportive at all. They just wanted to be popular. So I just thought, you know what, I'm going to start all over again. But unfortunately, if anyone's ever tried that method, whatever baggage you have, you just take it to the next location. So I moved overseas again and started from scratch. And, you know, I haven't only had terrible situations. I've also had some romantic ones that were fine. They just weren't the right person, but it was just a normal interaction. And in fact, I was dating a guy called Liam who was a teacher for a while, and he just didn't really have a direction in life. He was very wishy-washy. And I was very proud of myself because I managed to end that relationship because he was too wishy-washy. And I said, you know what? I deserve better than this. So I really gave myself a big, you know, tap on the shoulders, like, wow, good job, you know. And I guess I got a little bit overconfident. But what had happened with Ben is I'd made this sort of list of what to look out for, the kind of guy I would never go for again. And so here I am after this breakup with Liam. It's the start of the summer, a gorgeous summer. And I said to myself, I'd like to have a nice summer. I'm not looking for an intense romantic relationship. I would just like to meet someone and have some fun. So I go into the dating apps and I find Jeff. And this guy, this is the second one of the whole unholy trinity, is a Rambo. He's a Mr. Right. He's a water torturer. In fact, I would say he's most of them because I actually think he's a full-blown sociopath, but that's a whole other story.
And for those that don't know what a Rambo, a Mr. Right, or a water torturer is, we have an episode on the Lundy Bancroft book, Why Does He Do That? And the list of abuser types in there if you want to know a little bit more about that. But essentially, you know, the Mr. Right, you know, pretty kind of self-explanatory right there. The water torturer, someone who can speak pretty quietly, makes you think that you're the one that is crazy, is kind of the basic gist of that one, if you had to pick one thing. And the Rambo is someone that you think is your protector and wants to be your protector, but unless you do something that is bad enough, then they think that they have the right to abuse you and put their hands on you. And that's the main crux there of the Rambo in my very quick explanation for you.
Yeah, that's awesome. I also really enjoy when you do those specific topics as well when you cover those episodes. But indeed, Lundy Bancroft is definitely a book worth reading for sure. But what happened? So I was with this wishy-washy guy and I thought, you know, a bit of fun. I went on the dating apps and I saw this person who was a content creator who seemed extremely glamorous and interesting and was kind of an intellectual. So there was no kind of flags ringing for me because I thought, well, he's so different from Ben, who is just this out loud, charming social guy who was very much into being popular and stuff like that. This guy presented himself as an educated loner. And coming from my background as a kid as well, I, of course, was a loner, not by choice, but by situation. And so I feel an affinity when I see somebody like that, someone who's misunderstood and all that sort of thing. The thing that was interesting is we went on our first date and he was extremely cold to me. So because I was concerned about someone love bombing me, I thought it was very odd that he was super distant from me. He was kind of lecturing me throughout. I would make a silly dad joke. He wouldn't laugh at it. He just gave me nothing. And so I found myself really trying to impress him and trying to be, you know, effusive with my language, verbose, trying to be clever. And then eventually on this date, he decided to warm up to me a little bit. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. And he was going to do a project in Italy. And he said, you know, why don't you come to Italy and hang out with me for a couple of days while I'm there? Now, don't forget, I've just moved across the other side of the world. Migrating is very expensive. So I didn't have lots of cash to play with. But I thought, you know what, this could be a fun experience. And so I booked it and I made sure to book hotel days, even though he said to me, you could just stay in my apartment that I'm hiring. That I'm renting. And I was like, no, I don't. This would be our second date, so I'm not going to do that. We had a lot of contact in between the 6 weeks of that first date and me actually going there. And it got a bit sexual. You know, he started sending me suggestive stuff of him lying in a bath and all these sorts of things. And he was much warmer with me. He was giving me lots of compliments, which for me felt really great. It was almost like a gamification of dating, of like, oh, I've done all the right things. And now he's giving me that approval that I'm looking for. Never at this stage did I think, oh, do I like this person? Because he wasn't a very nice human being. But I, for some reason, was determined to get him to like me. And I also thought, well, he's not like Ben, so he's not abusive. But anyway, so I ended up going to Italy at great expense to myself. But the day before I arrived, he said, oh, by the way, I'm not sure whether I'm going to have time to spend with you because I'm really busy on my projects. So I've booked this trip to go see him, but he's really busy on his projects. So, you know, that's really nice to know. So we're starting off on a bad foot. Just when I'm getting some confidence, he's pulling that away from me. I turn up and he comes to the station with little mini flutes of Prosecco. And eventually I wear him down again. I managed to make him laugh and smile and be warm with me. And we ended up being intimate over the next couple of days on this holiday. He also, oh, you're going to ask a question. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to interrupt here because, you know, we did speak a little bit before, but I don't really know the nitty gritty of your story. We kind of went over things a little.
Yeah.
So something you said there, which was the gamification of dating. And a lot of people like already know that, like, some people play games when they're dating, you know, hard to get or these things. But that really just hit me right there, because based on who he is, based on who you are here,
yeah,
he's gonna stay in his lane.
Yeah.
He's made it a game for you to do all of the work. So right now, what is going on, if I fully understand, is that based on your personality type, and it might not work with many other different personality types, but with your personality, you are trying to unlock the levels of the game.
Yep.
And in the process of doing so, without him doing anything, you know, you're giving up little parts of yourself in this process. You might not think you are, and for a lot of people, you're like, what parts are you giving up? But, like, you're doing things and have no, I'm not going to use the word agency, but you're not thinking of yourself anymore. You're only thinking of him. You're thinking of the reward. You, right now, you are a mouse or a rat in a maze wanting to get that smile on his face. You don't even know if you like him. And so there's this kind of game going on where you are already just doing your best to get that smile, and you're only on date two. And it happens to be a trip.
Yeah.
Which is pretty crazy when you think about it.
Oh, it's so terrible. And it's also, again, in a way, he has all control because he's, you know, sitting pretty in an apartment that's been paid for, and I'm going over there just to meet him financially in a not very stable situation. So in a way, I'm isolated because I'm not around people I know. I'm in a new place and I'm just trying to impress this guy. You know, it's quite sad. You know, sometimes, of course, when people tell their stories, it's, you feel a bit sad for yourself when you're listening back. But that was it.
But like, his trap is his facade of who he is, what he does, all of those things.
Yes.
And then he's essentially the trap, if you kind of think of it that way.
For sure.
Or the end of this maze. And whoever gets to those things, he knows he has them because he's doing none of the work. He's doing nothing to think about you in any sort of way.
No, not at all. And also, when you think about it, it's the same reason why do we like luxury products? Because the price tag is higher. He makes it so impossible to get to the level for me to get his approval that it feels like it's worth more because it's not easy to get. But really, there is no you know, there's no man behind the curtain. There's nothing there. He's an empty shell of a person. But I think there must be something really exciting and mysterious because he's making it so damn hard for me to get there. So, yeah, he did an amazing job. What I didn't know is this was his livelihood. So he's a professional con man. So he's extremely good at this. He knows exactly how to read who and what to get out of them when he wants. So that it was interesting, that trip, because also it's when the financial stuff started. So as I said, I wasn't very well off at the time. I've done a lot of moving back and forth all over the place. But he basically said to me, look, I'm a content creator. I'm a creative person, but I don't have any money. So I ended up spending most of the money in that trip to try and like buy champagne or food or whatever he wanted to accommodate him. Then in terms of what is he giving me back, as a reward at the end of that, he did say how crazy he was about me, how incredible I am. He started writing me some poetry, serenading me, all these sorts of things. But I mean, really, what value is that? These are just empty things. But at the time, I was kind of swept up in it. And I was still telling myself, this is just a summer fling. So it's a bit of fun. Who cares how this turns out? Anyway, I went back home and he was away in Asia for a while and he was doing content creation there. And again, he said, look, we'd had a lot of back and forth in this time. He would want to speak to me several times a day. He would constantly be messaging me and he was love bombing me at this stage. This is when the love bombing really started. He was saying how beautiful our kids would look and all these sorts of conversations and stuff like that. And so he said, you know, you should come visit me in Asia where I'm doing my content creation and we'll hang out. And so I did go there. And while I was with him, we basically just explored jungle and all these sorts of crazy things. One thing I noticed at this stage is he was drinking a lot. I had noticed it earlier. I thought it was related to our time in Italy, but he was just drinking a lot. So one night he had many, many beers and against my better judgment, I got on the back of the motorbike with him through the jungle and he wasn't wearing a helmet. I wasn't wearing a helmet. And as we were flying through the jungle to a little town nearby, he said, all women are demonic. And this triggered something for me to start pleading with him to show him that I was not like all the other women. Obviously, it's a bizarre statement, but because I felt he was very misunderstood, he didn't have many friends, if any at all. He was just this personality online. He seemed to be ostracized from his family. I felt for him. I saw him and him, the hurt child, and I felt, okay, no, I'm here for you. I'm the person. You know, I wanted to be his family for him. So I'm pleading with him, saying, look, we get off the motorbike and he's sort of walking ahead of me and kind of running away from me, saying that women can't be trusted and his ex-girlfriends had done such horrible things to him and women had exploited him, which of course is you're nodding away. That's a theme that comes up more often than not.
I know, but again, right here, why I'm nodding is it's the gamification. He's creating now a situation where women aren't good enough. You know, no one's, you know, he's playing the victim. No, people have wronged me. You know, they've done this, they've done this, they've done this. And I don't know what's about to happen, but my prediction is you're going to try and prove that wrong.
Yeah, well, spot on. You get all points there. I did try and plead with him. So the thing was, I'm in an Asian country, extremely isolated, a rural little town. I don't speak the language, of course. My phone doesn't work because the reception doesn't work there because it's a European mobile. So, and also I don't have limited funds. So I'm stuck in this town running after him, pleading with him. He's my way home to the hotel. And I'm saying, no, you know, I'm not like that. And the frustration part too was I know I'm, you know, I try and always do the right thing by people. I am trying to be as good a person as I can be. So I was very frustrated. I'm like, I'm not like that. I will do whatever I can, you know? And so eventually I blurred out in this intense moment when he was getting rageful and abusive, I say, I love you. And he sort of melts and kisses me. And then that night, I'm lying next to him and I'm leaving the next morning. Again, another moment where someone creates a situation before there's, you know, a separation. That's a very common thing. And this happened again here but I'm crying next to him. I'm crying my eyes out. I feel so weird and I know something's not right. But again, I haven't done that work with myself to even feel my feelings. I can't put a name on them. And I'm thinking, this can't be happening again because this person's so differently abusive to my previous boyfriend that I just don't recognize. This guy's such a different person. His personality's different. Anyway, I leave mascara stains on his pillow. And as I'm at the airport the next day, he sends me proudly a picture of my mascara stains on his pillow, smiling, which is really kind of bizarre. Speaking of demonic, I think that qualifies a lot more than anything I could ever do. But anyway, I will fast forward a little bit here because through this push and pull, coercion, abuse, all sorts of gaslighting that's happening, lots of love bombing. I then get the ultimatum from him to move back to where I was living previously with my parents because he wants to move back to that country, but in a different city that I don't know because he has a really urgent project he has to do there. And this is another theme I come across a lot with these people is they will give you like a time limit. It's kind of really like a sale. You know, they make the price tag really high, but they say you can only get this for a limited time offer. So he forced me to move to the other side of the world, somewhere I didn't want to go back to, in a town I didn't know. Again, isolation. I just had built up a whole world for myself in Europe with a job and with friends. But he says to me, you know, we're going to get married. And I think, okay, maybe this is my shot at having a family. I've never had one. Maybe this person is really serious. Unlike Ben, Jeff was the first guy to say to me, look, I'd like to get married. I'd like to have children with you. I'd like to be really serious. And I was like, wow, he's really into me. He's really committed. So I moved to the other side of the world. And as you might guess, when we come to extreme isolation and huge investment on my behalf, the abuse escalates to an insane level. So the way it starts off is, first of all, I'm responsible for all the social financial stuff. So if we ever go out or anything, I pay for everything. But he gets to choose what movies we go to because otherwise he will complain throughout the whole movie that he doesn't like the movie. Or if I choose the food, he'll tell me he doesn't like the food. But I'm the person paying for everything. So there's a financial control element. We share an apartment together and it got to the point that he started telling me that he didn't like to hear the sound of me urinating in the toilet. So I would have to put on music to be able to use the toilet. The second part was obviously for more serious business in the toilet. I actually would go to the local mall to be able to use that because he felt disgusted by the idea of me having any bodily functions. So that's very extreme. These things all slowly grew, but at this point I've invested all the money I had left. I had told everyone I was going to run off with, you know, my future husband. And I had said goodbye to my job back home. So I had cut off everything that was a lifeline and I was in this new place. Of one of our first days together in this new town, I took him out for a drink and I paid for it and I took him out for some food. As we're sitting there, I say to him, hey, I just got to go to the bathroom. Could you look after my handbag? And he says, yeah, fine. So I go to the toilet and I come back and my handbag is left in the middle of the bar and he's outside smoking. And I come back out and I'm quite distressed because this is a very big city. I say, hey, you left my handbag, in this exact tone of voice. You left my handbag out, you know, inside. Why didn't you grab it? And he turns cold as anything I've ever seen. His eyes are just dark, dark black. And he said, don't speak to me like a child. And when we got back to the apartment, because our day was over right there and then, he wouldn't speak to me anymore. At the apartment, he started threatening me. He started degrading me by saying, you know, that I was such a slut for doing the sexual acts I'd done with him. And I actually pleaded with him and I said, hey, why are you, what's this? You know, you were all love and light and I was the mother of your children and all these sorts of things. And now this is how you've turned on me. And he said, if somebody wrongs me and speaks to me in the wrong way, this is what happens. I will turn cold and I will have no emotion. Again, this is a huge red flag, but I've already invested in the situation. A little bit later on, we have some nice-ish moments. I was never comfortable with this person and I never even really thought about whether I liked him. He basically was like an academic person that would talk a lot about history and all that sort of stuff and books he'd read. So he's a real intellectual, and he would always lecture me about stuff and think that I was dumb. But we had moments where we would go, you know, play basketball or do whatever, things like that. But then what happened was one day I'm washing the dishes, and this is a little bit TMI, too much information, but I was on my period. And anyway, as I'm washing the dishes, he comes up behind me and tries to just start having sex with me without any conversation or any interaction. And I push him off me because I feel unclean. I feel like, oh, I'm, you know, not ready for this right now. I need to have a shower and get ready or whatever. And I'm also a bit shocked by this sudden situation. He becomes extremely angry with me and tells me I'm not allowed to say no to sex. It's not an option. Our relationship will end if that's what I'm going to do. So we've got some lovely sexual control coming in there. Then something very strange happens. I start getting, because he's a social media person, I start getting weird messages of people warning me that I shouldn't trust him. And there's a variety of messages. I won't elaborate too much because this person's still very active. But there's basically indications that the things he's telling me is not true. I'm getting basically strangers sending me weird messages and text screenshots and stuff where he's actively, you know, either pursuing people for monetary reasons or he's having sex with them. At this stage, I'm fully locked in. I'm kind of scared. I don't know what to do. I'm extremely isolated. I don't know who to ask for help. A lot of it's very, other than those incidents I'm kind of explaining now, it was all very subtle. It was very nuanced. And he was very calm throughout all of them. But the fact that he was so calm was actually scarier than him being outwardly insanely aggressive in my face, because it was like he was really enjoying. One thing I noticed, he really loved abusing me. I could see that he really enjoyed all of it. He got a high of it, so to speak. Anyway, he went away on a research trip to India, and I get a message, a DM, saying that he is sleeping with a yoga girl there. And I don't know if to take it seriously or not, because he'd already warned me that there's a lot of people very jealous of him and his social media career. And there's women that have had their heart broken by him, and now they're out on revenge. So I've already had that story kind of prepped, and I'm thinking, okay, is that what this is? I don't know. But I do let him know in these 2 weeks of bliss while he's away that we need to figure out a relationship because it's not going very well. You know, he's controlling. First of all, he controls when I'm sleeping. He controls money stuff because I'm paying extra stuff. He's controlling when I'm going to the toilet. It just keeps expanding and expanding. So I say, look, let's have a chat when you get back. I don't know if I can be intimate with you right away. When you get back, we need to have a conversation first. So I prepped him for 2 weeks saying, I need some distance. Let's see what happens when you get back and have a chat. That night, he comes home when he gets back late at night. I'm already in bed because I got to get to work early in the morning. And he comes in drunk, as he always is. Now, he's a full-blown alcoholic, but most of the time you can't tell because he's so good at it. For him to drink is just him being normal, but sometimes he can drink even a lot for him. So he came home quite inebriated, and I'm lying in bed, and I'm very fearful. I end up actually documenting a lot of this stuff, by the way. So I recorded this particular conversation because I knew there was going to be a conversation, but I didn't know what was to come. So I've got this all recorded for my own sanity, because obviously he would gaslight me constantly too. As I'm lying there, he comes in and starts to kiss me and touch me and grope me. And I said to him, no, we discussed this. I can't be intimate with you right now. We need to have conversations first. First of all, I don't know if he's cheated. I never bring that up, but it's more that I'm scared of him. So I say, look, no, I don't want to do that right now. He ends up forcing himself on me, and I end up in a position in which I have my foot on his chest, and I slowly push him backwards. Because he's drunk, he ends up falling off the bed, and then he yells at me and says that I'm abusive. Anyway, he ends up successfully raping me, but he'll always bring up the fact that I pushed him off the bed. But you know, that's the power of hypocrisy, right? So the verbal abuse kept escalating. After that time, I didn't accept that was rape, because I thought of it like, well, it's my partner. How would I even explain that he came home and raped me? I didn't know it was possible to do anything about it. But I just found ways to avoid him sexually. I just, yeah, I tried all different kinds of methods to not have to have sex with him, basically.
So with this happening and everything that's happened previous here, you know, how are you feeling? You know, you also have a lot of people warning you of this person isn't the person that you think he is. So are you scared? Are you scared to talk to anyone about what is going on? And if so, because I can see you nodding a little bit there, by acknowledging it, does that make it real? And is that maybe the most difficult thing to deal with? Because, you know, within the context of the relationship, like, it's its own world. But saying it out loud or discussing it or saying I have a feelings about what has actually happened makes you feel the emotions that you might not want to deal with at all. And that might feel scarier than staying. Am I on any sort of right track?
As always, Brandon, you're spot on. Exactly right. I just wasn't connecting with it. But I also, don't forget, I didn't have friends around me because I was in a new town. So I didn't have the ability to speak with people and explain what was going on because it escalated bit by bit, slowly by slowly. And so I would have had to explain every single bit of context. Obviously, the rape was pretty clear, but the rest of it was just every single night he would keep me up with long lectures and he would quiz me about history facts and he would call me an idiot and dumb because I wouldn't know an exact date. All these sorts of things. So, you know, there was a lot going on. But yeah, I just wasn't connected with my own feelings. I did actually, it's funny, I have a voice recording. I was documenting everything for myself to make it real and to try and ascertain. And I remember I made this voice recording when I was talking to myself in which I was like, okay, done this, he's done that. And I was like, surely he can't be another abuser. I just couldn't believe that I would fail again. I felt very disappointed in myself that I could make the same mistake. The other part of it was a lot of people were moving on with their lives. So we're talking early 30s. A lot of my friends are getting married. You know, family members are married, cousins and stuff like that. And I'm the only single loser in my mind. And I could never quite get relationships right. So I really wanted this one to work. So I had made quite a fanfare before leaving to move and be with him about the fact that, you know, here is my person that wants me and he wants to marry me. And now I had to say, actually, you know what? He's raping me. He's violent and abusive and aggressive and extremely frightening. The other thing too, as you said, I was really scared. So one thing that happens when I'm this scared of a person, like I used to be with my parent, is I go into a sort of weird trance, like fawn state, in which I'm not reacting the way a person should. So, yeah, I did start to detach myself from him emotionally at this stage. And, yeah, I tried to figure out a way to make this stop. He did do the victim side of things as well, where he said, look, I need you in my life. You know, you're the one person in the world, because he didn't have anyone for a reason in his life because nobody wanted him around. But he did, you know, he did try and make me feel guilty, which was very easy in the past to make me feel guilty for just about anything, you know, be his social support and the love in his life, so to speak. I'll forward a little bit here. Basically, what ends up happening is, the abuse gets really extreme. And one of the other reasons I was confused is he actually thought I didn't dress sexy enough. So whereas Ben would always be like, hey, look, you need to be covering up, which was so confusing to me because I thought, oh, well, he wants me to be sexier, which is the opposite of the previous one. Is that still control? But of course, it's still control. It's just going in a different direction. So anyway, things got really out of hand. He ended up controlling when I slept. He would lecture me late into the night, being Mr. Right, knowing I had to get up early during the day to work all day. And he would stay at home in our apartment to work on his social media stuff. And yes, still a lot of the extra money came from me. He also, things started getting a little bit strange. He would start instigating play fighting and he would twist my arms behind my back until they started clicking and almost snapping my arms. So there was like a sort of a secret violence going on where he wasn't, you know, you wouldn't think looking at him, he was angry. I mean, I could tell obviously when I looked at him because I was always checking on his emotions, but he seemed really calm and he would do these sort of little sadistic things throughout. So I was very terrified of him. Then that escalated to him saying that he would strangle me in my sleep. He would also do this gaslighting thing where we were living in a really old European house. Oh, so the landlady told me that the house was actually haunted. And then one night after I got back from work, some of the furniture had moved in the room. And he told me, oh, it must be the ghosts. And then he would move it again the next day, but he would like gaslight me about it. But I was already on extreme high alert because of him. You know, I was sleeping maybe 3-4 hours a night. This was going on for 8-9 months. And so I was like a kicked dog. I would, if you burped in my face, I would probably start crying. You know, I was just extreme PTSD, really. And he tested that one day. He would always insist on walking me to places and dropping me off at specific places. And I used to think that was endearing because he cared, but it was really to monitor me. But he was walking me partly to work. And all of a sudden, without me knowing it, we're waiting at the traffic light. And he comes up behind me and he makes a loud, he goes like, poof, in my ear. And I end up falling on the ground, crying hysterically, because I just had no idea. I was basically extremely traumatized and everything was, I was just constantly on edge. Anyway, one night he becomes very violent, very aggressive, extremely verbally abusive. He's very drunk at this stage. And he starts to say to me, look, the only reason you give a shit about me calling you an idiot is because you know deep down you are a fucking idiot. And I can tell he's going to strangle me. And so I run out of the house. This is in the middle of winter. I'm wearing just a thin little cardigan. I've got my phone on like 10% battery. I run out of the house and I end up spending the night in a homeless shelter that night. And it was quite telling for me that I felt safer being in a room with 8 homeless men than to be with my own boyfriend. So, yeah, I end up, you know, being contacted after this relationship ends by lots of people and they're telling me the truth. A lot of his ex-girlfriends and I spoke, and it was really bizarre to hear the same stories coming right back at me. They're going to do this to everyone. With some, they might push it a little bit further. So with me, they pushed it further because I'm a very compliant person. This is how I also end up being what you call the main supply a lot of the time, because I'm super submissive, or I used to be back in the day. But yes, there's a smear campaign against me from this person currently. So yeah, that's been fun as well. Just things being twisted around, things being elaborated on.
So the end of this relationship happens. Do you go into therapy? Do you start to kind of deep dive about like what's been happening, processing your feelings, accessing your feelings, maybe try to work on putting yourself first or anything like that? Or do you kind of get into therapy but maybe avoid things? Or do you get into therapy, learn things, but then eventually you do meet a third person and this happens again? So kind of walk us through this part before you get to the meeting of person number 3.
It's a great question, and it's really such a crucial time for a man or a woman when they've left one of these relationships is to do that healing. The ending of that relationship was at the start of COVID. So I ended everything. I moved to another little area for myself, but then my job opportunities were slowing down because of COVID. In fact, the job I was working at was going bankrupt. So financially, I was in a really difficult position. And then I ended up trying to do some therapy and I got a little bit of insight. But to be honest, I would say Jeff was probably one of the most traumatic experiences for me because it was so intense physically also. You know, if whenever I came home, he was there and he was abusive. So it really took a toll on me. It should have taken me 2 years of full-time therapy to get over it. But I didn't have those capabilities. I knew I was not well. And so again, I said to myself, I can go into a relationship right now. So I'm not doing that. COVID happens. I barely have a job. I'm stuck in a tiny little room because I'm in a big, expensive city. And I'm extremely isolated. I have my friends. We talk on, like, you know, we did all the Google Meet chats and all that stuff. But it's not the same as actually seeing your friends and whatever. But then I get really bored. So we're talking 2, 3, 4 months into COVID. And there's not that sense of, like, when is this finishing? When is COVID over? So there's a lot of uncertainty. I get really bored. And so I go on the dating apps not to meet anybody. And I specifically said to myself, don't meet anybody. But just see. By the way, I'm sure everybody's groaning in frustration listening to this part. But I did lie to myself and say, look, I just want to have a chat to people. And I end up chatting for about a month with like 30 different guys. I never meet these guys. It's just about having conversations and having interactions and stuff like that. Then I meet the final boss in the game. I meet Gary. So I've come from somebody who's Mr. Right. He's the smart one. I'm the dumb one. He's, you know, gets to dictate everything. He has no friends and all that. I then on the dating app find somebody called Gary who seems to be a very sensitive guy. He's very open about his vulnerabilities. And he seems to have a lot of male and female friends as opposed to my misogynistic ex-boyfriend. And so I think, okay, maybe this is it. This is a nice situation for me to speak with someone. Again, I tell myself I'm not going to go into a relationship. But I think it's clear now that I'm addicted to this stuff. So it's like a heroin user saying, oh, I'm only going to use a little bit of heroin. It's a very silly thing to say. I can't control myself when I'm not well. And I shouldn't trust myself to be dating if I'm not well. So yeah, that's a really important thing to mention at this stage. I'll make this real quick with him. You know, he seemed to have good family ties, as I said, friends like that. And during COVID, socially, things were very dry for everyone. But we managed to meet up and hang out when it was allowed to hang out in parks and stuff like that. So it was just exciting and fun, you know, coming from this extraordinarily dark, isolated place with Jeff. Here I suddenly have, you know, a lot of liveliness. This person seems very interesting and stuff like that. The one thing I will say, the big mistake I made on the first night that we were intimate, we got really drunk and I ended up telling about my sociopathic ex-boyfriend. And he then keeps referencing throughout our relationship, Gary keeps referencing that no matter what, he's not going to be as bad as Jeff. So he can't really do wrong. Now, when the benchmark is someone who is a sadistic person who raped me, I don't think that's the benchmark anyone should ever set themselves to, but that's how it goes. He says it to me in a joking way. Anyway, we have a lot of love bombing. We have a lot of making me a dinner. And my ex-boyfriend, Jeff, was also a homophobic. So he's not homophobic. So he's got all these qualities that I would look for as a person who's a kind person. And he has a full-time job, so he's a, you know, we're not going to be struggling for money together. He invites me to his brother's 30th birthday party. So I go to his brother's 30th birthday party, and this is the chance for me to meet his family, and I also meet his friends from high school. I can tell he's very, very nervous at this stage, and I don't know why, because the friends back home, they like him, but they've only been friends with him for a short period of time. So I didn't know this at the time, but that friendship was pretty superficial and short-lived. They don't really know him that well. But these are the people that know him really well. So I'm at this party, and the strangest thing is he leaves me right away. So, like, he doesn't even introduce me to people. He just kind of leaves me by myself with strangers, and I feel very awkward. But I'm trying to kind of talk to people, but people are quite cold to me. And for me, that's quite unusual. You know, growing up the way I grew up, I'm pretty good at trying to build rapport with people and have a chat with people. I can talk about just about anything, but they're quite cold and aloof with me. I think that's quite strange. But anyway, he's in the shed doing cocaine all night and talking to some of the guys. And I'm by myself sort of just wandering around this party, trying to make friends. And all of a sudden, the women, this is hours later, the girls of the party, they corner me and they ask me, are you really serious about Gary or not? And I was like, yeah, we're really getting on. And, you know, he seems to be really sweet and I really like him. And they're like, okay, you got to make sure you keep him on a tight leash. And these women are quite aggressive with the way they're speaking to me too, which I thought was quite strange. So I feel very defensive. And I'm like, you know, he's a really good guy. And they're like, well, actually, he's violent. And first of all, I'm like, oh, my God, not again. I'm just like horrified. But anyway, yeah, they basically explained to me that some of the incidents that happened with his ex-girlfriend, where he used to drag her out of the bar by her hair, all these sorts of things. And, you know, some of you listening might think, how could you keep doing this? How does this keep happening? Just for explanation, I was speaking to many, many different men on the dating apps, but this particular guy, Gary, without me knowing, was sort of mirroring back the stuff I wanted to hear. He started speaking the way I spoke. He started making the same jokes as me. And I thought, oh, we're getting along. This is the one I want to meet up with, not realizing that part of, obviously, the whole pattern. That's how I keep getting into this stuff. So yeah, I was, again, really upset that this happened. Gary comes back. He's high as a kite. And he overhears people talking about him. He gets into a rage. He gets extremely angry. He's a very, very big guy. And he uses his size a lot to kind of get his way. But he runs out of the house. Again, I'm in a town that I don't know with strangers. So I'm, you know, I have to run after him. And he's swearing and effing and blinding outside. He's so angry. And I'm actually at this party, the only person there defending him, trying to stand up for him, saying how much I like him and stuff like that. So anyway, I run back inside. I say, look, I'm going to go get your stuff and I'm going to get my handbag and we'll just leave. I run back out, grab the stuff, and I give him his jumper. And as I turn around, he hits me with his full force with the jumper in the back of my head. I reasoned that away by saying, well, it was a jumper. It was a soft object, which is ridiculous. It doesn't matter. It just so happened to be a jumper. It could have been very easily been a beer bottle. And also because I didn't see why he would hit me, I couldn't understand it. It was like this complete disconnect between what happened and me, basically. Anyway, he basically said the next day he couldn't remember anything. I said, look, never, ever can this happen again or I will leave. I said, I've already lived with violence. I'm never doing this again. If that ever happens again, he goes, I don't know what happened. I think it was an accident or something like that. Because I didn't see him actively hit me because my back was turned. I reasoned that it was some weird accident where he was flailing his arms around. But I know that that's not true. Anyway, and other people saw it as well. As time passed, there was signs of infidelity. I stepped on an earring. I used to not wear earrings, so I knew it wasn't mine. He said that he'd vacuumed from under the bed. I found the dating apps on his phone. And every time that happened, I would say, okay, well, look, we're done. And he would hoover. He would plead. A couple of times, he would even fall on his knees and beg me. He would fake cry, which was the most interesting thing I've ever seen. I didn't know that was possible. He would sob without tears. I didn't know that was something people did. It was the most uncanny thing I'd ever seen in my life. But anyway, we ended up ending. He was cheating on me the entire time. He was extremely abusive. This is basically the short story. But the real abuse also continued after we broke up, where he wouldn't accept that I was done. So he would stalk me online, and he would send his cousin and him would stalk me online and send me weird little messages. I ended up getting rid of my social media entirely so people can't speak to me at all. He would first send me a hateful message. Then a couple of weeks later, he would try a loving message. And then I'd been very good about not having contact with him. But then he suddenly did something pretty serious. A few months before that, I'd actually lost my cousin, who was 26, to suicide. And my cousin had told me that she was going to commit suicide. And I thought, because of my experience with suicide, I thought, if you're talking about it, you're probably not going to do it. That's a common misconception we have. she did unfortunately go through that, and it had a gigantic impact on my family and me. And he was aware of that. He knew the depth of misery that brought everybody. And so suddenly I got an email saying he was going to kill himself. So I reacted right away, rushed over to see him, and he ended up coercing me into having sex. And then I just realized, okay, never again. So there was some interaction after that a few times, but I realized really it started landing that this was just insane and I couldn't continue. This relationship went on for about 1.5 years, but really went on for 3 years because the post-abuse separation just kept going. I eventually ended up just deciding I could never even speak to him ever again.
So at the end of that relationship, now it's this trio, or as you call it, the unholy trinity. With the last one, I guess, what was your thought process after that ended? And, you know, if, like, was there a moment after that where there's like a catalyst in your head that says, okay, like, what is my life? Who am I as a person? How do I figure that out? Where do I even begin? And then in the process of that, how do I feel about relationships as a whole? Is it something that I actually do want in my life? Is it something that so much has happened? How do I trust someone again? How do I trust myself again? Do I even have a compass of what is right or what is wrong? Because so far, my compass hasn't worked.
No.
So there's a lot of fear and scariness about what the outside world looks like. And are you comfortable saying, like, I'm okay being alone? And I guess that's a lot of questions right there. So just kind of go into that and tell us a little about, like, the process of what happened after.
No, I really appreciate that. And it's so integral the way you've structured that as well. It's so true. You know, what is rock bottom? Obviously, I mean, don't forget, I'm giving you just some highlights and some easy to explain concepts, but I could write books and books and books about every single one of these guys. Really what's going on with me at this stage is I remember after I just couldn't go on with Gary anymore. And this was like very close, right? The situation, Jeff and Gary are separated by about 4 or 5 months. So I have like 4 or 5 years of straight abuse just topped on each other and different forms as well. So it's just all the different elements of me being hurt throughout, which is not very healthy for a person. So to be honest, I was a shell of a person. So I remember looking in the mirror and not recognizing myself, because I also hadn't thought about, like, what do I like? Like, I'm always trying to be some compliant, submissive, the right person, you know, and they're cleaner and whatever they want me to be. Like, what is going on here? And, you know, I've tried all the stuff. Again, I've developed an eating disorder with Gary as well. But it's not enough. I'm not beautiful enough. I'm not fun enough. You know, I'm really successful with work. Like, why is nothing enough? And so I remember looking in the mirror, not feeling like a person. And I couldn't think of why I am a person. And then I always do art as well. So I'd drawn this really intricate pen drawing. And I saw that hanging on my wall. It's this beautiful little floral garden. And I realized, well, that was drawn by a person. A person drew that. And that was the moment where it all kind of clicked for me that, no, I'm a person. I'm my own person. And I started adopting a term which is called non-serviam. I'm not here to serve other people. It's a Latin phrase. And it's something I believe in now, is that first and foremost, I need to be okay. You can't pour from an empty cup. And I'm as much a person of anyone as anyone else. Really all this was, and I guess that's the kind of the stuff I wanted to cover today the most, is these men were just symptoms of my lack of self-love. I had no relationship with myself. So when someone demanded something of me, because I had no boundaries or ideas of what I thought was important, I just did them. I just complied because I didn't care about myself. It's another reason why it's so important for us to also, when we do journaling and documentation and stuff, to write it out and then read it back. Because sometimes if we read something as a third in third person, then we actually go, actually, you know what? That's really crazy. You should never accept that. Because if anyone had even told me about being pissed on in the shower to be degraded, I would have called the police and I would have had that person in jail. You know, if that happened to a friend of mine, but I didn't think of myself as a friend. You know, I thought of myself not at all. I didn't think of myself as a person. So that was a long journey to connect with myself and start to actively think, what do I like about myself? What is my value? My value cannot be anything external, like how I look or how successful I am financially or in creative projects. It has to be about who I am inherently. And all of us have inherent value, and it's super important. And also, I am a powerful person. I have power. I just never knew that. So it's about taking that power on, really. That's one of the major things. And I just wanted to, you know, shift the focus back to myself. I need to know how I'm feeling. I need to be able to identify how I'm feeling. I could have noticed throughout, you know, let's look at the symptoms of what's going on with me. I'm so focused on trying to please this person and get them not to be violent or aggressive or abusive that I'm not going like, hey, I'm developing an eating disorder. I'm not sleeping. I'm not taking care of myself. Those are really the things you need to be checking in with yourself. Don't focus so much on like what specific abuse is this person doing. Of course, that's important. But really, you'll notice the first signs of you being with the wrong person is how you're feeling. And if you're disconnected from that, the relationship can go on for a very long time because you just don't notice it. So I would very much suggest that. And the other thing is, even if it feels bad to leave them, just keep going, because addiction is a liar. So if you're in an addicted situation with a toxic person and you're scared to leave them and you're like, oh, but I should stay with them because it hurts so bad. No, just trust me when I say this to whoever's listening. The pain will go away. The trauma bond will be broken and you will be fine. You can live without them. They're not healthy at all. Lastly, also, I just want to cover, you know, the smear campaign stuff. I had that. Different varieties of that. I don't really care what people say to me after, like these abusive people. I don't care about their opinion. Where I come from, we would say it goes over my head like an elephant's fart. You know, their opinion's not important. They're not good people. They do this to everyone. So whatever they say, just ignore it. It's not, the shame and guilt's not with me. I don't need to feel any shame or guilt. So they can say what they want about me. Of course, if it gets into legal territory, I would suggest to do something about it. But just general talking shit behind my back, they're welcome to do so if they want, because their opinion is meaningless. And then I guess lastly is healthy paranoia. The theme throughout here is every time I think I'm in the clear and I've got to figure it out, and then I don't. So even now, your question, would I want to find love again? I'm surrounded by love now. I'm surrounded by support. I'm only surrounded by kind people. In terms of going into a heavy commitment, I don't know. That's not my focus right now. Really, my focus is me, which feels really entitled and even still makes me cringe a little bit because it feels gross to even say that. But if I'm not okay, then nothing. No, if my relationship with myself is not okay, my relationship with nobody is okay. So I need to make sure I fix that first. And that's really it from my end.
Well, you've just given us a lot of wisdom, but as I say to everyone at the end of every episode, if you had any words of wisdom, final words of wisdom, what would they be?
Love yourself. That would be really it, because if you love yourself and you know yourself and you understand yourself, it will be your best defense against abuse.
Well, Emma, I really want to thank you for being here with us today. We did an unconventional structure, doing three stories. And, you know, in our first call, I wasn't all there when we were talking the first time. And I just had a sense of, you know what you're going to do. And you knew, I just had a sense like you knew how to tell your story the way you wanted to. And you did so today, discussing the little nitty-gritties of a lot of different types of abuses, multiple different types of abusers. So I know so many people are going to, you know, find the gem that they need to hear today through all of your different stories. And I'm just happy that you're, you know, on the other end of all this, through a lifetime of going through abuse and low self-worth and not feeling good about yourself, and that you're here and you've been working on things, and that you have a good group of support, which is very, very important. So just a really big thank you for being here and sharing your story with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Brandon. You're such an inspiration to me. You've really changed my life. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you, Emma, once again for being our guest today on our Survivor Story episode here. And if you want to be a guest like Emma was today, go to our website at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a button that says guest form. When you click on that button, it takes you to our guest form page. And there you can read all of our instructions and either send us an email at narcissistapocalypse@gmail.com or fill out our guest form and press the submit button. And please do send it in the format that we ask for. And if you are someone that needs support, we have a support group at narcissistapocalypse.com. Top of the page, there's a support group button. Click on that button, and you'll see inside that we have Zoom meetings every Wednesday night, Thursday afternoons, and Saturday nights. We have forum boards for you to post on to get the validation that you need from survivors just like you. It is a wonderful group of people on there, and you can make a lot of friends too. So if you need support, join our support group today. And if you need even more support, please go to domesticshelters.org, domesticshelters.org. They have articles and resources to help you make sense of what you're dealing with. They have every phone number, email address, and web address for shelters and agencies, no matter how big or small the town you are in. Domesticshelters.org has it there. So if you need help from them, go to domesticshelters.org. And we have another friend of our show, and they are called Shelter Movers. And Shelter Movers can be found at sheltermovers.com. And what they do is they help you move all of your stuff from your home and into storage. And that means your pets and livestock too. So if you're trying to get out of domestic violence and coercive control, and you need help leaving your home, getting all of your stuff out of your home, sheltermovers.com can help you get all of your stuff into storage, including your pets and livestock too. It is currently only in Canada, and it is a donor-supported charitable organization. So if you need help from them or just want to donate to them, go to sheltermovers.com. And that is it for today's Survivor Story, today's episode. So for myself and Emma, we hope you have a good night.